Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
9 civilians are killed in a Taliban hotel attack, and no signs of a missing jet's wreckage in the Indian Ocean. I'm Francis Alonso reporting from Washington. Afghan officials say 9 civilians were killed when 4 teenage Taliban gunmen penetrated the security of a luxury Kabul hotel with guns stuffed in their socks and opened fire. The Interior Ministry spokesman Sadiq Siddiqui said the 4 attackers were shot dead. He also confirmed that 4 civilians were among those killed.
The attackers were killed in 3 hours by the Afghan security forces. Unfortunately, 9 people were also killed by the attackers. 4 of them foreigners from New Zealand, 1 from Canada, and 1 from Pakistan and India. And also 5 others were Afghans, among them 2 children and 2 women. And there were 6 others wounded in this attack.
The Taliban is claiming responsibility for this attack. The militant group has promised to disrupt plans for the April 5th Afghan presidential elections. There are still no signs of wreckage from the missing Malaysian passenger jet after a second day of intense searches over the vast waters of the Indian Ocean. One pilot from New Zealand said he was disappointed but still hopeful as searchers would find possible debris from the aircraft that was spotted by a satellite a few days ago. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott told reporters his country is throwing everything they've got into the effort.
We have an Australian naval ship which is steaming as fast as it can to the area. It is an extremely remote part of the southern Indian Ocean. It's about 3,000 kilometres southwest of Perth. It's about the most inaccessible spot that you could imagine on the face of the earth. But if there is anything down there, we will find it. We owe it to the families of those people to do no less.
5 search planes are combing that remote area as part of an international effort to locate possible debris from the missing Boeing 777. The Malaysian Airlines jet disappeared March 8th with 239 people on board. The surveillance aircraft participating in the search includes planes from Australia and New Zealand, 1 U.S. Navy plane as well. Malaysia's defense minister said China plans to join the search on Saturday, with Japan, Britain, France providing additional assistance. Russian President Vladimir Putin today signed legislation completing the annexation of Crimea, while Ukraine initialed a deal for closer political cooperation with the European Union. The Kremlin signing ceremony took place after the Federation Council voted unanimously to incorporate the Crimea region into Russia. President Putin and the Crimean leader signed that treaty on Tuesday. In Brussels, meanwhile, Ukraine's interim prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, signed a political association agreement with the European Union. Also today, the EU added 12 people, all Russian or Crimean, to a list of those subject to travel bans and asset freezes, raising the number of such individuals to 23. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama, accompanied by her Chinese counterpart Peng Liyuan, visited a school on the first day of Mrs. Obama's 5-day trip to China. The two participated in a calligraphy demonstration today before visiting the former Imperial Palace in Beijing's Forbidden City. The First Lady spoke earlier today.
The relationships between the United States and China couldn't be more important. And having the opportunity to travel here to listen, to learn, to hear more about the education initiatives here in this country, and to share my travels with students throughout the United States is a very unique experience, and it's one that I will never forget.
Mrs. Obama is scheduled to deliver a speech on Saturday at the Stanford Center of the prestigious Peking University. The leaders of Japan and South Korea have agreed to hold 3-way talks with U.S. President Barack Obama. Those talks will happen on the sidelines of the international conference in The Hague next week. Turkey has blocked access to the social media network Twitter as the government battles a corruption scandal just days ahead of local elections. Turkey's main opposition party said it will file a legal challenge against the court decision to block the online social networking and microblogging service. The Republican People's Party said it will also file a criminal complaint against the Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. I'm Francis Alonso, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
we're seeing a surge in government bombings and ground attacks on villages in certain areas of Darfur, like Jebel Mara, South Darfur. And then we're also seeing clashes by militia groups.
That's Leslie Lefko of Human Rights Watch, who says civilians are suffering from an upsurge in violence in Darfur. Also, the International Committee of the Red Cross reports that one of its staff members was killed in Darfur yesterday. The second round of the South Sudan peace talks has been delayed over the issue of who can participate. And anticipation remains high in Egypt over Armed Forces Chief Field Marshal Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's expected announcement that he'll run for president. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Senegal, and our feature reports. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a rights group says civilians in Darfur are caught in the crossfire between government forces and rebels, as well as between rival militias. Human Rights Watch is calling on the Khartoum government to end alleged attacks on civilians and release demonstrators recently arrested for protesting the violence. Leslie Lefko is the group's deputy director for Africa. From Amsterdam, she told VOA's Joe DiCapua that the violence in Darfur has sharply increased over the past month.
We're seeing a surge in government bombings and ground attacks on villages in certain areas of Darfur, like Jebel Mara, South Darfur. And then we're also seeing clashes by militia groups, which is a somewhat separate strand of conflict. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced, scores of people have been killed, and it's a really worrying surge in violence against civilians.
Are you seeing this spread out over all three Darfur states?
It's mainly in North Darfur and South Darfur. But the other pattern that I want to mention is that the violence in Darfur has prompted protests in Khartoum, partly by Darfuri students, but also others. And what we've seen simultaneously is a crackdown on those protests, with Sudanese government forces using excessive force, lethal force, shooting protesters. One student died about a week ago, and detaining many, many people, including human rights activists.
Tell me how you're getting this information about what's happening to civilians in Darfur.
We have some people who are quietly gathering information for us on the ground. It's a difficult and dangerous job, but there are some very brave colleagues who are trying to do their best under difficult circumstances, given the access problems to Darfur and to Sudan more generally for human rights groups.
Tell me about some of the stories they've told you.
People describing the Sudanese Antonov planes circling near villages, dropping bombs, people being hit, including children being hit by shrapnel from these bombs while they're trying to flee. There was one terrible story of an attack in an area called Tijir in South Darfur, where there was first a bombing in late February, and then on the same day when an 18-year-old girl and two young boys went to try to get medical treatment after they were hit by the shrapnel, then government troops actually entered the clinic and started shooting.
What's behind the fighting between the militias?
There's been a pattern of clashes between different militia groups for the last year or more, which is partly on ethnic grounds, but it's also very much resource-related, where different groups are clashing over access to resources. One of the interesting facets of what we've been documenting recently is the name Musa Hilal, if that rings any bells. He has become a kind of notorious militia leader over the last 10 years in Darfur. He recently sort of defected from the government and is now kind of running rampant in Darfur and is also involved in some of these clashes. And apparently the government has been sending people to try to negotiate with him to bring him back in line.
You're saying Hilal was once connected with the Janjaweed, is that correct?
That's right. Musa Hilal was sort of one of the most prominent and notorious Janjaweed militia leaders in the early years of the conflict in 2004-2005. I actually was part of a Human Rights Watch team. We interviewed him in 2004 in Khartoum. But over the years, his allegiance to Khartoum has fractured. He left the government some time ago and has, for various reasons, maybe partly because promises were not fulfilled. But I think what this shows is the quite confusing picture we see in Darfur today, where there are different types of violence.
So it appears to be a very complex situation, perhaps even more complex than it was when it was just rebels against the government. So what should be done, in your view?
All along in Darfur, what we've seen is the Sudanese government either unwilling or in some times unable, but mostly unwilling to kind of take the steps that are needed. But having said that, I think there are still concrete things that the government can do. Part of the problem we see in Darfur is impunity, the government refusing to actually undertake meaningful investigations and prosecutions of people who commit serious crimes. Changes of some of these policies would help. You know, I think the other issue here, and this ties back to the protests in Khartoum, is again, we're seeing an unwillingness by the Sudanese government to actually deal with these often peaceful protests in the right way, and then covering up the really horrific crimes that have been committed. I mean, you know, there were 170 protesters who were shot dead in September in Khartoum, and the government has not dealt with this appropriately. They've just tried to censor the media, to deny the responsibility, and to cover up and ignore the need for justice.
Leslie Lefko is Deputy Director for Africa for Human Rights Watch. From Amsterdam, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. Meanwhile, the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, reports that one of its staff members was killed in Al-Fashir, Darfur, yesterday on March 20th. Namadan Zali Musa Bizhara, a Sudanese national, was working as a warehouse storekeeper. He was hit by a stray bullet while on his way home from work. I spoke with Asiya Kambal of the ICRC in Khartoum about the killing.
Our colleague Najmuddin Saleh Musa Bishara was driving home with three other people in a private car when he was hit by a stray bullet. He was very committed and we're extremely sad to have lost him.
Do you all have any idea who killed him?
The exact circumstances of his death remain unclear, but we are in touch with the police investigating the case.
Was he heading home coming from work?
Yes, he had left work and he was hit by a stray bullet while he was on his way home from work in a private car.
Were the other people injured?
Actually, we do not know the exact condition of the other three individuals.
I understand this is the second time in a little over a month that someone with the ICRC in Sudan has been killed. What was the other occurrence?
The other incident actually was for the Sudanese Red Crescent Society, where a volunteer died in a landmine explosion in South Kordofan.
With the shooting death of your colleague, is there growing concern of security in the area? And also, is this something that happens on a frequent basis with workers in the area?
No, this is not something that happens frequently for us.
Do you know what type of investigation will take place?
A police investigation is currently taking place.
So at this point, then the ICRC, they just have turned it over to the police and we'll wait for them?
Yes. The police is running an investigation currently, and at this point, we are also in the process of understanding what exactly happened.
That was Asiya Kambal of the ICRC. She spoke with me from Khartoum. Fourteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The second round of the South Sudan peace talks has been delayed over the issue of who can participate. Marta Vanderwerf reports from Addis Ababa, where negotiations were supposed to be underway.
South Sudan's government made clear it doesn't want to take part in the peace process if a group of former high-ranking political leaders, whom the government detained after fighting broke out in December, joined the talks as a third party. Former minister and political detainee Deng Alor says without this group, the political divisions in the Juba government that precipitated the fighting remain and there will be no peace.
The problems started within the political bureau, started with us. We differed on issues of reforms and democracy within the party. We insisted on reform. So if you want to resolve this crisis, you've got to resolve the differences within the ruling party.
After more than 3 months of fighting, the only achievement of the peace process has been a ceasefire, which has been repeatedly violated since January. International diplomats are losing patience and this week warned all the stakeholders there will be consequences for those who obstruct the progress. U.S. Special Envoy to South Sudan, Donald Booth.
If the government or any other actor tries to undermine the peace process and rebuff the IGAD heads of state, they will face consequences. The people of South Sudan expect renewal. They expect their voices to be heard in forging a more sustainable peace. Business as usual is not a viable way forward.
General Taban Dengai is the lead negotiator for the opposition, loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. He says that unlike the government of President Salva Kiir, they are willing to talk with all concerned.
We shall discuss peace with whoever in the table. Government alone, we are ready to sit with the government. With the other political leaders, we are also ready. We hope for inclusivity, but if government insists, then it can only be us and they. I don't think we adjourn peace because of other political leaders.
Civil groups also came to Addis Ababa this month to discuss how they can be included in the peace talks. Lona James, who heads the South Sudanese Women's Advocacy Group, says the people are suffering in the fighting and they too deserve a voice in making it stop.
Urge the IGAD mediators to accredit representative of civil society to the peace process as an important stakeholders, provide funding for their involvement and to maintain a platform for dialogue between civil society and the conflicting parties.
Mediators from the East African Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, have not commented on the latest delay. Fighting has killed thousands across the country. Hundreds of thousands of people remain displaced, and there are warnings South Sudan could face a famine unless farmers feel safe enough to return to their homes and plant their fields. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Thank you, Marta. The UN Refugee Agency reports tensions between local residents and Sudanese refugees in Maban County in South Sudan's Upper Nile State are boiling over. The UNHCR says many people are fleeing their camps to other countries in fear. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports recent reciprocal attacks between South Sudanese residents of Maban in Upper Nile State and Sudanese refugees have forced up to 8,000 refugees to flee from the Yusuf Batil camp. UNHCR spokeswoman Fatoumata Lejeune Kaba says the refugees since have returned to the camp, but tensions persist and have spread to the Doro and Kaya refugee camps. She says the villagers and refugees are fighting over limited resources, including wood, grass, and grazing land. She says the hostility between the two groups reached such a fever pitch recently that both groups set fire to each other's houses, tents, and granaries. She tells VOA the villagers themselves are suffering as much as the refugees.
They're not in any better shape than the refugees, and this is all due to the current situation. Maban is an isolated area with the fighting since December. It's been one of the hardest hit areas, and people can't just, whether it's humanitarian agencies or commercially, people can't just go in and out of the town. Just the day before yesterday, when I was reading the reports, when I was talking with my colleagues on the ground, Maban was under the control of rebels. This morning, it was taken over by the government. So there's a lot of fighting going on.
Maban County hosts 125,000 Sudanese refugees who fled from embattled Blue Nile State. The UNHCR says one-third of the refugee population is made up of small children, pregnant and lactating women, as well as the elderly, disabled, and people who are chronically ill. Fighting between government and rebel forces broke out in South Sudan in mid-December. Since then, Instability and conflict in Mabon County have disrupted the planting and harvest seasons. In addition, aid agencies are having great difficulty transporting food and other supplies to the region because of insecurity along the roads. Lejeune Kaba says local residents are very angry over the growing food shortages. She says they are demanding that some 60,000 refugees in Yusuf Batil and Gendrasa camps leave within 2 months.
Realistically, we can't do it. The rainy season is coming. 60,000 people is a lot, and this Mabon is an area where you can't move people fast. You need trucks, and we don't even want to get to that situation where people would have to be moved to, because it takes a lot to identify a site. The land on the sites we've identified belong to people. You have to negotiate with them for them to agree to take them in. And if they learn that there's been fighting, I don't think they would want to welcome refugees.
Lejeune Kaba says the UNHCR is working with authorities and other humanitarian agencies to defuse the tensions. Mabon County is close to Ethiopia. She says the governments of South Sudan and Ethiopia have agreed to let the World Food Program bring much-needed food supplies into Mabon through Gambela in Ethiopia. She says the food, which will be distributed to internally displaced people and refugees in the coming days, should help reduce some of the tensions between the refugees and locals. Meanwhile, she notes, insecurity and hunger are forcing more South Sudanese to flee into neighboring countries. She says Ethiopia currently is receiving an average of 1,000 South Sudanese refugees every day. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 22 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Human Rights Watch calls on the Khartoum government to end alleged attacks on civilians and release demonstrators recently arrested for protesting the violence. The International Committee of the Red Cross reports that one of its staff members was killed in an Al-Fashir Darfur yesterday. And the second round of the South Sudan peace talks has been delayed over the issue of who can participate. And of course, we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237. Anticipation remains high in Egypt over Armed Forces Chief Field Marshal Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's expected announcement that he'll run for president. El-Sisi has been widely expected to resign from his army post and declare his candidacy since the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces gave its public support at the end of January. Michelle Dunn is Senior Associate of the Middle East Program at the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. My colleague Ashinafi Abeji asked her if it is a given that Field Marshal Abdel Fattah el-Sisi will run for and win the presidency of Egypt.
There's been a bit of a delay. While it seems that General el-Sisi has been getting various arrangements in order, whether it's inside the military or preparations for his own campaign. But frankly, all of the other possible candidates on the nationalist part of the political spectrum have eliminated themselves. So it now seems certain that General el-Sisi will run. And certainly if he runs, he will be elected because no one else will run against him on that same ideological ground, that is the nationalist ground. No Islamist probably will run or be allowed to run. And the only other person who has said that he will run is the Nasserist Hamdin Sabahi. And I don't think anyone believes that Sabahi could win election.
Now, if, as you said, al-Sisi gets elected president, what issues do you think he's likely to tackle as a matter of priority?
I think that Field Marshal el-Sisi recognizes that Egypt faces an enormous economic challenge. And we've seen some reports already that he's likely to announce some economic mega projects when he announces his candidacy to give Egyptians hope that the economy will improve. However, Egypt continues to have a very bad security situation with nearly daily terrorist attacks and demonstrations going on at least weekly and some very large-scale human rights abuses that are going on and further fueling radicalization. Unless he can reverse that, unless he can get the security situation under control, it's going to be almost impossible for him to get the economy moving in a positive direction.
Now, the Field Marshal is regarded as a fairly decisive figure who often takes bold decisions, they say, and yet not much political experience in his resume. How do you think that will play out if, in fact, he assumed the role of the president?
Well, first of all, one has to ask whether someone who has spent his entire adult life in the military and very much has a military view on things has the answers to Egypt's problems. The economy, for example, the military has already a vast role in the economy and seems to be expanding it right now. Is that the solution to Egypt's economic problem? Most people think that it's ultimately the private sector rather than the state that can generate the millions of jobs that will be needed for Egyptians. So there's a question as to whether he's going to have the right solutions coming from where he comes from. Also, he is the person who has overseen a massive crackdown over the last 8 months since Morsi was removed. So there's no indication so far that he has any kind of an orientation toward political inclusion and reconciliation or anything like that. I think General Assisi is going to struggle with some of those things because of his lack of experience in the political or diplomatic realm. At least initially, when General Assisi becomes president, the state will mobilize behind him and try to support him and also protect him, which they didn't try to do at all during President Morsi's time. So that will be initially, but we'll see how long the honeymoon will last.
Now, some, in fact, go to the extent of saying the very notion of another military man as president actually inspires fear. Is that a widespread sentiment in your view?
In Egypt, there is a certain percentage of the population that is inclined toward Islamism. And, whether they are supporters of the Brotherhood or of the Salafi groups or perhaps of no particular group, but just are Islamistly inclined. And I think a lot of those people will be very uncomfortable with having the very general who removed President Morsi become president. So I can't tell you what percentage of the population that is, but it's significant.
Michelle Dunn is Senior Associate of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. She spoke with my colleague, Ashanafi Abeje. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
In Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me. I'm Heather Maxwell for Music Time in Africa every Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC.
The Voice of America, VOA.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Human Rights Watch calls on the Khartoum government to end alleged attacks on civilians and release demonstrators recently arrested for protesting the violence. The International Committee of the Red Cross reports that one of its staff members was killed in Al-Fashir, Darfur, yesterday, and the second round of the South Sudan peace talks has been delayed over the issue of who can participate. Coming up, we'll have music from Senegal and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're tipping off today with college basketball.
Kim, let's tip off with one of the most popular sporting events here in the United States, the Men's College Basketball Championship Tournament. Now, this single elimination competition starts with 68 teams, and eventually only two will vie for top honors in the national championship game on April 7th. The title game is played at a different location each year. This year, the contest will be held at AT&T Stadium near Dallas, Texas. Because of the upsets in the tournament, especially in the early rounds, the tournament has become known as March Madness. And there was more madness in a few opening round games on Thursday. Let's highlight those upsets. Number 12 seed Harvard, usually known for its academic prowess, defeated number 5 seed Cincinnati 61-57. Harvard never trailed after the opening moments, and the Crimson of Harvard will play the Spartans of Michigan State in the next round. Cincinnati is based in the U.S. state of Ohio, and there was also an upset in a game between two Ohio schools. Number 11 seed Dayton edged number 6 Ohio State 60-59. In another upset, number 12 seed North Dakota State top number 5 seed Oklahoma in overtime 80-75. The games will continue over the weekend. Later Friday, number 2 seed Kansas will take on number 15 Eastern Kentucky. The Jayhawks of Kansas feature a top Cameroonian center, Joel Embiid. But Embiid has been having back problems lately, and he's not expected to play this weekend. The Jayhawks also have Andrew Wiggins, maybe the best freshman player in the country. Wiggins is expected to go either number 1 or number 2 in the 2014 National Basketball Association draft. Let's take a short break for this important message from a former NBA star who played his college basketball here in Washington for Georgetown University.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
Brazil will host Croatia June 12th in Sao Paulo in the opening match of this year's FIFA World Cup football tournament. The Samba boys from Brazil have the proudest pedigree of any of the 32 World Cup teams, and they're one of the favorites to lift the trophy at football's premier event. I've been talking with a few of my soccer-loving Voice of America colleagues ahead of the World Cup, and one of them is Hakeem Shamo, who works behind the camera in our video department. I asked Hakim to rate the chances of the Brazilians winning a record-extending sixth world title on home soil.
Their chances, Sonny, they have a good chance of winning the World Cup, their sixth title. For many main reason being a home advantage, playing every game is like a home advantage for them. And at the same time, fans are expecting, you know, them to do well because they are a great team. And I think that most of those players will do really well.
Hakim, who are some of those top players for the Samba boys?
Well, first, you know, you can't talk about the Brazil team without saying Neymar. You can't, you know, he's a huge player and a huge benefit for the team. But I think that the team needs other than just Neymar. Some of the other players that I want to mention are Thiago Silva, for example. He's a great defender and also a captain. He did really well in AC Milan, and then when he went to PSG, still doing great. And I think that a good key player is him, and also defensive midfielders. Paulinho, Gustavo, some of these players I think are going to be a huge factor for the team.
Hakim, how important is head coach Felipe Scolari to Brazil's World Cup success?
Well, his name kind of speaks for itself, basically. Scolari is a great coach. He won a World Cup in 2002, and recently when he came back and Brazil wanted to coach again, he also won a Confederations Cup. And I think that he's pretty much putting almost every factor, every player, into this squad, especially playing for friendlies. He's bringing almost every player into the team and wants to see how much he can do with the squad.
That's my soccer-loving Voice of America colleague, Hakim Shamo, speaking with me at our VOA headquarters here in Washington.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Africa Service of the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
Game on, sports fans. It's a rest day at the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup Football Tournament in Costa Rica. There are three African sides in the 16-team tournament, and two of them, Ghana and Nigeria, have already clinched berths in the quarterfinals. The Ghanaian girls and the Nigerian girls both have the maximum 6 points from two matches. By the end of the day on Sunday, we'll know who Ghana and Nigeria will be playing in the quarterfinals. Meanwhile, the third African team in Costa Rica, Zambia, will be playing only for pride Saturday after losing its first two matches. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma says the Zambian girls will wrap up play against the host country. Mark has that story as well as other sports news.
Tomorrow, Saturday, in T-Bus, Zambia face Costa Rica as Ghana tackle Canada, while Nigeria encounter Mexico in San Jose on Sunday. Staying with women's football, Ivory Coast welcome defending champions Equatorial Guinea in Abidjan in the qualifiers for the Africa Women's Championships this weekend. Ethiopia play Ghana, Zimbabwe host Zambia, Senegal face Cameroon, Comoro Islands play South Africa, Rwanda engage Nigeria as Algeria face Tunisia. Meanwhile, the Union of North Africa Football Association boys Under-17 tournament starts in Rabat, Morocco today, Friday. It includes Algeria, Egypt, Libya and Morocco. Turning to rugby, South Africa and Kenya face off in the opening encounter at the IRB Rugby 7 series in Tokyo, Japan tomorrow, Saturday. They will each play Argentina and Japan in other Group B fixtures. At the start of the sixth leg of the nine-part series, South Africa are second with 97 points, two behind reigning champions New Zealand, while Kenya is eighth with 47 points and Zimbabwe 17th with 1 point. Turning to athletics, the 19th edition of the FISU World University Cross Country Championship takes place in Entebbe, Uganda tomorrow, Saturday. A record 12 of the 23 teams at this biannual event will be from Africa. Japan are defending champions in both the men's and women's contests, while Algeria were the best placed Africans at the last championships in Lourdes, Poland in 2012. They were third in the men's contest and seventh in the women's event. This is the second time the event is being staged in Africa after 2006 in the Algerian capital, Algiers. Finally, in Tunisia, over 3,000 athletes from 17 countries are vying for honors at the Stride of Megara Half Marathon Championships in the Tunisian capital, Tunis, on Sunday. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing all a sporty weekend.
African football news, Kwesi Appiah, the head coach of World Cup-bound Ghana, is scheduled to leave Accra today, Friday, on a 10-day trip to Liverpool, England. Appiah, his goalkeeper's coach, Nassam Yakubu, as well as three other members of his technical staff, will observe Liverpool and the club's preparations for its English Premiership matches. Ghana Football Association President Kwesi Nyantachi says it's a great opportunity for the technical team to visit Liverpool and will go a long way in helping Ghana's preparations for the World Cup. The Black Stars of Ghana have qualified for their third consecutive World Cup. They've been drawn in what many are calling the proverbial group of death at Brazil 2014, along with the USA and European powers Germany and Portugal. This is not the first time Coach Appiah has visited England to pick up some coaching tips. He's also visited Manchester City on several occasions, most recently last April. And a quick Premier League update on Liverpool. The club will be in Wales on Saturday for a match against Cardiff. Liverpool is 4 points behind first-place Chelsea, but has played one less match. Cardiff, meanwhile, is facing relegation. The club has 25 points, 1 point more than bottom of the table, Fulham. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
All right. Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, researchers have developed a vaginal gel that is effective in protecting monkeys from infection with an AIDS-like virus. And proponents of male circumcision are in a difficult fight over cultural barriers. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's Point Shore of Senegal with Seka.
Kelamati, Kelamati, Jamamu, Jamamu. Taruba, taru,
Ulay,
so melon ni man,
fo jaar ñu dajé so meloon ni man yëkkatil 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 gisuma dara yëkkatil gisuma dara man zeka duma jël ni jani bax yëkkatil ma xol sa pointir asalo asalo ala xalé yi lugo lay sile sek lugolo kaw rax dangal sky ñu dem banar asalo 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 jëkër jugal u paajam sa sa mbaxal won ma sa noti xala bi kula rabal fil de bas la rabal sa sa noti sa sa mbaxal asalo Ousmane Diop asalo Sibinan Mbaj asalo Alain Dien asalo man seka duma jël ni jali bax yëkkatil ma xol sa poyet
music from Senegal. Well, in most African nations where male circumcision programs are underway, proponents are in a difficult fight over cultural barriers. Reporter Gibbs Dube looks at some reasons why circumcised men are also abandoning the use of condoms.
Ernest Dlamini of Mbabane City, Swaziland, was circumcised in 2006 to enjoy what he calls a clean life. Dlamini says he is worried that a large number of men circumcised under current programs funded by international organizations are now abandoning condoms and engaging in unsafe sex.
There are many circumcised men who think they can now have sex at will as they are circumcised. They think they can no longer contract HIV.
This promiscuous behavior is attracting the attention of some married women who are now blocking their partners from the medical procedure. Zimbabwean Senator Sitembile Mlotshwa believes that male circumcision is causing a lot of havoc in most Southern African communities as circumcised men forego the use of condoms.
You tend to think that if this man goes through this circumcision, maybe he's going to be too much. Maybe I'm going to fail to contain this man.
Mlochwa argues that those abandoning condoms believe that they are too clean to contract HIV.
After you are circumcised, you say, what then am I protecting myself from? Because I now have a clean sheet.
Commercial sex workers have taken advantage of the situation, charging more money for providing services to circumcised men who don't care whether the ladies of the night are HIV positive or not. Two commercial sex workers operating in Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo, say these circumcised men are having sex with them at their own risk.
These circumcised men say they do not have any diseases because they are circumcised. In most cases, they offer us a lot of money. One of the circumcised men I had sex with on the first day gave me $100. I am HIV positive, but there is nothing I can do. This man is always coming back for more sex, even though he doesn't know my HIV status.
Officials in South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Swaziland say they are fighting these myths among circumcised men to ensure they do not contract and spread HIV. To worsen the situation in these nations, some people strongly believe that foreskins are being used for witchcraft purposes. Hila Hlanganani Tungeni, operating from Zimbabwe's Makokoba crowded suburb, explains.
Some people, especially business operators, come here looking for foreskins, but we do not give them anything because as members of the Zimbabwe National Traditional Healers Association, we do not use foreskins for any purpose.
Dungeni says all foreskins are bent following a traditional circumcision procedure, just like what happens in hospitals where they are incinerated.
Whenever we conduct these circumcision ceremonies, we burn foreskins, and this is normally witnessed by those attending the traditional ceremonies. If you do not do that, some people can take you to court thinking that you sold their body parts.
But Mlochwa doubts that all foreskins are burnt or incinerated soon after a circumcision ceremony.
Us in Africa, we're always looking to do better at our work, do better in our marriages, make more money, and we're looking for something mysterious. So then I think it can be true that these people can now think of those foreskins that are put there in a box and now try to coax this medical doctor to sell them.
Some HIV/AIDS experts say there is a need for further research on the effectiveness of male circumcision, as some circumcised men may be spreading HIV at an alarming rate. Gibbs Dube reporting for VOA News.
And in our next feature tonight, researchers have developed a vaginal gel that is effective in protecting monkeys from infection with an AIDS-like virus. The main potential advantage of the microbicide for humans is that it can be applied to women after intercourse, even several hours later, increasing the likelihood that it will be used. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The vaginal gel was 84% effective in shielding a group of female rhesus macaques from infection with SHIV, a hybrid of HIV and the primate version of the virus. Four of the six monkeys treated with the gel up to 3 hours after exposure were protected against the virus, while all macaques in the placebo group became infected. The study reported in the journal Science Translational Medicine is the first to demonstrate the effect of a microbicide following sexual intercourse. Waleed Hanaini of the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was one of the lead investigators. He says the experimental compound, which contains the anti-HIV drug raltegravir, works by blocking the virus from integrating itself into cells and replicating after it enters the body.
We showed that this step takes more than 6 hours, and therefore provides ample time for dosing or for treatment with the gel vaginally. And we showed in the CAC model that this modality works and protects animals from infection.
His team also found that the monkeys were protected from SHIV when the gel was used a half hour before exposure to the virus. Before starting clinical trials, researchers need to confirm that the microbicide would offer similar protection against HIV in humans. If it does, say experts, it could put women in better control of their health, according to Melissa Robiani, director of biomedical HIV research at the Population Council in New York. Women would not have to negotiate with their partners about protection against the deadly virus.
Pre-treatment or pre-dosing of a product, in this case a gel, presumably is more cumbersome to the woman, and maybe a post-exposure regimen, as is suggested from these studies, would be more acceptable because they would potentially be able to do it in the absence of their partner knowing.
Gauging the microbicide's acceptance and ease of use will be an important part of the clinical trials once they begin. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Boyatak Zoniak, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Rising political tensions in Burundi ahead of next year's elections have sparked violent clashes between police and opposition activists in recent days. Actions taken by both sides are inconsistent with the Central African nation's notable progress toward creating a peaceful democracy. In two separate incidents on March 8th, government officials took action to break up political gatherings being held by two different opposition parties. Police used heavy-handed tactics to stop a peaceful rally by the women's wing of United for National Progress to mark International Women's Day. Later, police dispersed a gathering of another political opposition party, some of whose members subsequently congregated at the headquarters of the Movement for Solidarity and Democracy political party, or MSD. Two police officers attempting to arrest three MSD members who had taken refuge in the headquarters were taken hostage by opposition members. Following unsuccessful mediation, police assaulted the building to free the hostages. The police and opposition members exchanged live fire during this confrontation. Authorities later issued an arrest warrant on insurgency charges for the MSD's chairman, Alexis Sinduije. The United States deplores the acts of violence by both government officials and opposition members in the incidents, which follow a series of restrictions placed on civil and political rights in Burundi. Restricting public gatherings in this way has a chilling effect on public debate. We urge the government of Burundi to adhere to its human rights obligations and to respect the constitutional right of the political opposition to hold peaceful gatherings. It is also imperative that all sides refrain from the kind of violence seen in the March 8th clashes. It is important that all sides respect the democratic process so that Burundi can hold free, fair, transparent, and peaceful elections in 2015.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
time in Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me. I'm Heather Maxwell for Music Time in Africa every Saturday and Sunday at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC.